Thank you so much for tuning into Let's Talk, the official podcast of the National Runaway Safe Line, or NRS. At NRS, we operate the federally designated national communication system for youth who have run away, are experiencing homelessness, or who may be considering leaving home. For over 50 years, we've provided crisis support and resources for young people, families, and communities across the nation. My name is Christopher, and I'm the Director of Marketing and Communications for NRS, and I hope you'll learn as much as I do on this journey to elevate the voices of young people and youth-facing organizations as they share their stories and highlight the complexities and intersections witnessed by 4.2 million young people facing homelessness each year. Today, I'm joined by David Ambrose. David is a best-selling author of A Place Called Home, a sometimes devastating but totally inspiring memoir about experiencing homelessness as a child of the foster care system. On top of being Emmy nominated, David was recognized by the Obama administration as a champion of change, and he's also an honoree at the National Runaway Safe Line's annual Celebrating the Spirit of Youth fundraising gala. Welcome, David. And I want to emphasize really quickly that you've been a national poverty and child welfare expert for many years. What made you decide that now was the right time to share your story?
You know, as I approached my middle, late 30s, I realized a couple things concurrently. One, this vision of myself as having achieved everything that I sought to achieve was not true, that I had this core part of myself that was still deeply traumatized and cut off from the world, which was any part of me that felt deeply. And I had walled that off upon entering foster care because of the violence of the streets and then the violence of the system itself. But the problem is I never took down that wall, and I built a whole foundation and house above it. And if you have a crappy foundation, you're not going to have a great house. So over time, I began to realize I needed to deconstruct to reconstruct. And my foster son helped me realize that, my ex-husband, my family. And in doing so, I realized part of that was releasing the shame. I think I had a big giant sail and plenty of wind, but my anchor was still set. And I had places to go and things to do. And I needed to release that weight. And part of that was the shame. Part of it is also you have to be vulnerable in order to form real relationships. And I had perfected the art of not doing that. So writing this book put my heart out there. And I would say the biggest other reason is the statistics are too similar to when I was a child. The statistics coming out of foster care are daunting. If you're more likely to die than go to college. You're more likely to go to jail than go to college. The number one source of sex trafficked girls in our country is foster girls. We can do better. And I think in order to do better, we have to be vulnerable with people and tell our stories and motivate people. So I decided for all those reasons to put it out there. And it has been one hell of a journey.
It's wild how powerful it is to be able to say things out loud, or in this case, writing them. That's definitely how I was able to process my experience as a queer person who didn't feel safe coming out until I was an adult and kind of on my own. And that all boils down, of course, to not feeling like I could trust my loved ones to keep me safe if I didn't exist as this image they had put in my head, you know, and that society had really put in my head. There's one chapter in the book where you experience this huge argument with Steve, and that leads to this emergency placement at a new home and the need to change schools. And on top of that, you still have to be worried about social issues with your peers because you not only recognize that you're gay, but you also fully recognize how society perceives gay people and how that can affect your situation. When we look at the data from this past year, I believe that peer and social issues is now one of the top five reasons that young people are actually reaching out to National Runaway Safe Line, alongside mental health issues and emotional and verbal abuse. Was there anything that the adults in your life could have done to help ease that pressure of the social issues?
So I think there's this odd thing that goes on for young people coming out of any type of non-traditional upbringing where you go from 60 miles an hour to zero, and adults in your life use phrases like be a kid, which mean nothing to you. So if you've grown up in an environment where you have adult responsibilities and pressures and you experience whatever type of trauma and violence, it's really hard to turn that off. And I'm reminded of Hamilton when they say he's got no chill. Learning how to just be in a space with my peers was something I only recently have started to really understand how to do. And that was well into my 30s that occurred. I could be put in front of a room of legislators. I could be put in front of a room of 1,200 to speak, no problem. But if you asked me to hang out without a purpose, I would be lost. And so I think when young people are moved around or they're experiencing this anxiety, I can only speak from my experience, I felt like I was a Martian landing and no one spoke any type of language that I spoke. And I didn't understand the behaviors. It was really challenging. And the things that were on my mind and the things that I were experiencing behind the scenes were not things that young people talk about. Too few. So in terms of the adults, I would say whatever the adults can do to not have that kind of fake go be a kid, you know, it should be an invitation, not a mandate. And also give kids space to not be some sort of idyllic version of what they think they should be. I don't think adults can make friends for us, but they can be our friends. They can be people that are more consistent in our life, that are open and vulnerable with us, that are not Mount Rushmore, but are alive humans. And I had too few of those in my life. I had folks I interacted with on a kind of transactional basis. So I think adults understanding that young people coming with trauma have a different set of kind of behavioral and norms and expectations would be helpful. I also think adults control decisions. You know, me moving around as much as I moved around was the result of adult decisions. And so first of all, do your job and make sure that the best interest of the kid is what's really guiding the star there, which means we have to examine, you know, the overcriminalization of poverty, the removal of kids from families, all these things that adults control. Because ultimately, if you're dealing with a kid who's having an ill transition, you're really affecting a symptom, not the problem. The problem is way back down the line where you've removed that child without a decent plan or a system that's able to help and handle it, or helping the family overcome whatever they're dealing with. My best adult in my life growing up was my mother. Second only was Holly, my foster mom, who did not come through any type of training ultimately and just raised her hand and said, I'll be this kid's foster parent. And in that experience, she was vulnerable. She taught me a lot. And then I continued that on with my Spain experience. But I think that's what I would suggest for adults to do.
While I was reading the book, I remember having this vivid flashback to when I decided as a kid that I would never tell my parents that I was gay. My mom found some suspicious activity in our browser history, and while she was confronting me about it, she said something to the tune of, well, if you really want to kill your parents, being gay is definitely the way to get the job done, or something. I don't know. That dumb little sentence that my mom doesn't even remember stuck with me for years and years and years.
Sure.
What advice do you have for foster parents or social workers who are facing kids that have built walls based on these types of experiences?
So the law is pretty good now. It wasn't when I was growing up, but the law around kids in care with regards to their sexual identity is actually pretty good. It's much better in terms of what's considered ideal policy out of organizations like the Child Welfare League of America. And I was part of that. We worked very hard to change what's considered best practice with regards to affirmative care. Coming out is just profoundly traumatic. And regardless of the affirmative nature of the environment you're in, it is a daunting thing. You can hear a message from an individual all day long, but mother culture and our society, even today, are debating our very essence, our existence, and those of our trans brothers and sisters or drag queens. And what we recognize as a queer community is that's just the start. We have been debated for the last 100 years in this country and criminalized, and we thought we made it. Now we're fighting again. A young person hears that. Especially the vulnerable, you know, the most vulnerable in that population, like trans kids of color, they hear it. So you can have the most loving parent on earth, but what you realize as a queer kid is like, it's dangerous out there. You know, for years, I wouldn't be in places where I would feel comfortable holding my husband's hand. In California, there are places in the country that I don't go visit because it's not safe for me to be my true expressed self. When I travel internationally, I look at the State Department's guide to see if I'm going to be arrested for being. And you have to check those things. So no matter what we tell our young people about some sort of idealized, it's okay, I love you, the world may not, and they know that. So I think one thing I always recommend to adults is candor. And I am not a sociological or psychology expert, But what I always appreciated from adults in my life was candor. You know, when my first social worker was dropping me off at the delinquency facility, she warned me. When I wanted to go back to one of my foster homes, she's like, lie and just apologize. She taught me how to emancipate from foster care. And what an unfortunate choice of words that is, but that's what it's called. And so I always appreciated candor. And I was not ready to come out. I had experienced sexual trauma and violence and a society that messaged me from the moment of my first awakening when I was in shelters with people dying of a disease we didn't understand called GRID, which became AIDS. So it's hard to counter all of that messaging out in the world, especially for a young person whose faculties are still being developed in terms of cognition and processing and emotion. And then you layer on intersectionality, like I am a cisgendered white dude that's gay. Like I can't even imagine what other people go through to climb another mountain. That seems impossible. So I think we just have to be candid with folks. The other piece is policy is not good enough. There are great laws on the books. What's going on in the field? How do you recruit and retain social workers that are not just tolerant, but embracing? How do we recruit more gay foster parents, queer foster parents, and adoptive people? How do we continue to push law so that kids in foster care are treated with full human rights and dignity as opposed to toleration? And we have to keep fighting for that because these kids don't vote. They don't have the vote. We as adults and queer people who come through the system or as queer people in general, we have to reach back down and help these kids up because they're us. And we now have the power and responsibility. So I appreciated candor. I also recognized growing up that it was not safe. And no matter what anyone said to me, I recognized that. So I protected myself. And it took me years into nearly my 40th year to get to where I am today. So the other thing I would say to kids that are listening to this or their loves, be patient. It is one hell of a journey. And I know many 40-year-old straight people that are still on a journey. Never mind coming up in a society that discriminates and hates our very existence. So be patient and love.
I do. I love that. And my partner and I will hopefully be foster parents one day. We totally want that to be one of the ways that we contribute to the greater society, you know, by equipping young kids who identify as queer with the tools and the resources that they need to excel in society without having to like compromise any part of themselves, which feels like it should be so easy. But then, you know, I'm from Nashville and that's a place where it seems like a place where I call home is actively out to get me. And as queer people, we also see how these vague bills go from appearing to be about one thing to being something completely different. Mm-hmm. Like today, they're talking about drag, and tomorrow they're talking about trans rights, and the next day they're talking about gay marriage. And all the progress we've seen starts to slowly unravel, or at least that's how it feels, you know? So it feels important as an adult to be one of those people who's stepping in to fill the gap for queer kids. One of the most asked questions about the book from our board of directors is why it seemed like no adults were stepping in to help, or if there were any organizations at the time who were proactively looking to help young people in your situation. What should youth-facing organizations or foster parents or whoever's in a young person's life do to make sure that these young people feel safe?
Well, first of all, I think you should foster immediately. Don't wait for perfection. Holly was, I think, 28 when she became my foster parent with no experience and no money. So your question is really, you know, what, again, like what can adults do? And do you know what we think about all the time, but we never talk about?
What is it?
I'm going to whisper it. Sex.
That's true.
All of us think about it every 30 seconds. All day, every day. None of us talk about it. It is verboten. I drive around Los Angeles and I see billboards of people shooting each other all the time. You know, incredible violence is completely acceptable. But sex is this bizarre thing. And then you roll in, and I'm going to speak as a gay man. I can't speak to everyone's identity. As a gay man, we are confused with our identity, with the act. My very existence as a gay man is conflated with the fact that I sleep with men. Those are distinct. And so you have the conflation of identity versus act, which is an expression of my identity. And so into this muddle come young people who are trying to figure out the world almost as if they have no eyes, ears, or mouth, and they only have these two hands and they can't figure out what they're touching. And then we have silence. profound, deafening, shameful silence. Just about heterosexual sex, never mind gay sex, never mind all the other rainbows of sexual expression that we are a part of in this community. How did you learn how to have gay sex? I can tell you my story, but this is not the platform. It was not artful. It was not safe. And it was built upon a mountain of self-hate and loathing that was taught to me by society. So I think one of the things adults can do is destigmatize conversations about sex. I don't need you to lecture me about where babies come from. I'm pretty sure most people know where babies come from at a certain age. I'm not a sociological expert, so please take that with a grain of salt. But I'm pretty sure most 12-year-olds in America are aware where babies come from, especially if you've grown up in poverty. So why don't we talk about sex? Why don't we have an hour a month where you talk about sex, talk about your sex life, talk about whatever. And it doesn't have to be perverse or gross or inappropriate, but we have to destigmatize conversations about sexual relationships, about emotional relationships, about emotional sexual relationships, about alternative relationships, and just create space for it. Talk is free. I think a lot of times people are like, what can I do? I don't have a 3-bedroom house. Donate your small talk. Donate your talk. Create a safe space where kids can know. You know, I have a friend's child who they believe is gay. And he is an early teenager. And, you know, I'm not going to out this kid and be like, I know you're gay. I love you nonetheless. Or to your parents, they're freaked out because you're not telling them. Not a helpful thing to do, I've read online. But you know what I'm doing? He comes over and cooks with me. I share with him my dating life, appropriate aged conversation. And then I make sure he's around me and my friends. So he sees positive role models. So if you're a heterosexual parent, how are you creating space where your kids are seeing you interact with trans people, where they're not considered circus freaks or news, but just humans living their life in the beautiful complexity, messiness of it? How are you creating that space? Your kid sees you doing that and then interact with those people. Talk is free. We allocate our talk every day. We allocate our time. And most of us do it anesthetized, sleepwalking. What if we were intentional about it and we realized that we have to have these conversations about the most intimate thing that humans do, and then do so in a way that's healthy and role modeling for their child, especially breaking down silos, especially in the queer community. We do such a poor job of interacting with each other. There's jokes about this group or that group not talking to each other, or this group is going to fix that, and this group is going to wear a thong, and like we just kid about it. But there's a seed of truth in it. We got to do some internal community work as well. We can't just expect straight people to figure their stuff out. We as a queer community have to build bridges to each other and really, really do some hard work to support each other and then bring our straight siblings, friends, coworkers along. But I would go back to your question just to punctuate it. Talk about sex, talk about relationships, not just in the ethereal. Be vulnerable and age appropriate, but be vulnerable.
Oh, yeah. We spoke to several different organizations to recognize Human Trafficking Prevention Month in January and Teen Dating Violence Awareness Month in February. And that was a common theme, education and conversation. I mean, I had no one to talk to about these things. And I'm so fortunate because I wasn't making smart decisions. And I'm lucky that I'm like a 6'4" black man, and at least I'm a little intimidating by nature.
You know, it's interesting you say about that 6'4" tall black man privilege. You know, I think about the disproportionate impact on all this cogitation in our society about trans people and the debate about them. And then if you look at the hierarchy of who's in danger, it's like, you know, women of color, trans women of color or drag queens of color or anybody. And it's, I think it does go both ways. And the other thing I would just note is talk about joy. I think we start a lot of sexual conversations about like, avoid this. This is what the herpes looks like. This is bad. This is rape. Super important. But we crave sex for a reason. And it's not just the act or the payoff. It's a relationship. It's the intimacy. I think it's one of the reasons girls are so vulnerable coming out of foster care is this need of love and approbation in addition to other traumas. So I think we have to talk about relationships in a much more profound way to role model, especially, I can only speak for myself, I did not come from a healthy household where I saw healthy relationships. And so I think conversations with adults that are thoughtful, educated, and informed, that either with myself or they bring people in their life that are like me, would be so helpful for young people.
Do you see any depictions of relationships in the media that make you think like, wow, I wish I had this growing up so I would have understood this earlier or understood it differently?
Gosh, all of them. You know, if you saw a gay person, it was a neutered version of a gay person, where they hugged but didn't kiss. You know, rarely were they seen in a bed intimately together, whereas I just call constant heterosexual role model sex and relationships. So I also grew up largely without content, growing up homeless. I didn't consume it. In fact, the first time I saw a television, understood what it was, I don't know how old I was, but I was young, and I saw a TV in a waiting room in a wire mesh cage. And I looked up and I saw the Bengals Walk Like an Egyptian on MTV. And I said to my sister, I started crying. She's like, what's wrong? And I said, Jessica, do they get a break? And she's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, the little people in the television, do they get a break? I literally thought there were people inside the television. So content to me is interesting, kind of coming into my older age. I watch very little TV, and it's not because I'm better or worse than anybody. Just it's not a thing I grew up on. There were none. And if there were, it was bad. It was around a disease. It was around toxicity. Today, I think it's much different. I think it's much better. And there's powerful figures in the queer community that are shining lights, not just for the queer community, but the whole damn country, if not world. Like, I'm sorry, but RuPaul is on my mind. She posted something with GLAAD about trans people and drag queens. And I just was, I wanted to rally behind her. Or, oh my gosh, the creator of Pose. Oh my gosh, his name. The creator of Pose.
Oh, Ryan Murphy.
That's the creator. But, oh my gosh, the main actor. African-American man.
Oh, Billy Porter.
I went to an Outfest movie event where he got an award. And his, whatever the hell he identifies as, fabulousness, he got up there and gave this rallying cry, calling all of us to task. And I just walked away being like, yes. And that is a person on television. That is an icon in our country, if not world. So I think there's so much better representation today. And it didn't happen magically. It happened because we organized and fought. And that's part of the thing I talk about in Child Welfare is, we don't realize it, but we're part of a movement. And I think it was best described by Dr. King, who talked about a poor people's movement. And I would say a poor kids movement. Is all these organizations are serving youth are part of this Dumbledore's army. And we need to work together. Because the full ecosystem of health of these kids is going to be a healthy community that's not overpoliced, that has opportunity, that's not overpolluted. The schools are good, if not great. Food is available. So that the kids are healthy. And all of us are in that fight together. But yet you see these silos where like, this is the feeding program. This is this program. This is that program. So it's not enough to have icons. We have to do the work to organize and build bridges amongst each other to get these kids and young people to achieve whatever.
You just made me think of a moment in a place called home where you exclaim to yourself, oh, I have a boyfriend. And I think it's like your first, the way you realize that you have your first boyfriend and you were so young. And I think I was like 20 years old or something when I had my first boyfriend, and it caused me to have a mini breakdown because I felt like I was overwhelmed by this idea that I'd committed to becoming my parents' worst nightmare. And I started cycling through all of the gay representation from the media that I had for so long convinced myself that I like hated and was so against. And it's funny that you bring up RuPaul because that was totally one of the images. And unfortunately, when I was younger and still coming to terms with being gay and being out, I try to separate myself by being like, oh, drag is too far, or being trans is taking it too far. And I was trying to make sure that I was still palatable for my straight friends. And in a lot of ways, I was holding on to this idea that I could still make myself fit in. And luckily, I had an amazing queer family who knew exactly which season and which episode to show me first so that I could have this immediate aha moment. And it blew the lid off of everything that I knew. There were so many people who came from the same background as me and like the same weird things that I did and talked just like me. And now I'm obsessed and I recommend it to everyone because it really is a show about self-actualization mm-hmm. and living your best life unapologetically, as cliche as that sounds, which I believe that everyone is old in this life. You know, I feel like that's the dream, is to be able to live yeah. unapologetically. And I'm sorry, I know I went off on a tangent there.
So well said. No, I'm like waiting for your book to be written. This is the meat of the matter. And we've been there all along. Like I just finished a book called My Country Means to Kill Me by Rashid Newsome. A phenomenal book. And it's historic fiction, but it's based in reality. And I sort of knew about some of the figures in the book, but really this the history that it reveals in terms of civil rights, like Bayard Rustin is one of the featured characters in it. I had heard of him, but I didn't really know much about him. Here's this queer man of color who co-led and co-founded and worked alongside the icons of civil rights, like Dr. King, and no one even knows him. So I think we've been there all along. We need to tell our stories and share our stories, especially vulnerable kids. I end the book, if you remember, with a list of famous foster kids that have grown up, you know,
some, the world. I didn't even know.
Yeah. But I did that because it's just what you're saying. What if everyone turned purple that had touched the system in any way, shape, or form? Had a foster sibling, was a foster kid, was in juvenile justice. What you would see is you know these people. They are your family. They are your friends. They are your colleagues. And then we work harder to make sure that every kid can achieve that, whatever their potential is.
I agree. One of my friends has convinced me to write out my experiences of being a child who grew up online. Like, my first gay tribe were people who I met on a forum when I was like 16 or 17 years old. And I'm still friends with a lot of those people in real life today, actually. And I always feel like we come back to this question on the podcast about internet safety and whether or not it's good that kids have the level of access that they do today. Because the internet was definitely the wild, wild west when I was growing up in my like teen years and early 20s. But now there's even more access. There's even more ways for people to get connected. And social media has made young people easily accessible.
I think the internet for young people growing up in any which way that experience difference or isolation, I think the internet can cut both ways. I can cut many ways, and depends on the minute of the day, if not the second. So it is in and of itself a tool, and it's what we choose to do with the tool that really is what manifests outcomes. And when I think about young people, I think about, are they fully capable in terms of their cognition and development to handle a tool? We don't give young people access to guns. We don't give them alcohol. We've made strategic decisions about what young people can do. And we jokingly age gate the internet, which is not terribly effective, as you just described. So I don't think about the internet as in and of itself something that has a quality. I think about us as adults and our responsibility and opportunity to make sure that young people are fully supported as they mature, and we kind of grant and facilitate access to tools that match their capabilities. You know, I think all the time about, you know, when I'm going to be a father, and will I allow my child a smartphone? And I think the answer is no. I just don't think so. I think about all the things that might go wrong with that. And then I think about the utility of what it does. When I mentor young people, one of the things I ask them to do, I do mentorships that are short in duration, and I ask them to keep track of what they do every 15 minutes for a couple days. And then I put it into all these charts and graphs and I show them. And what they see is, aside from going to the bathroom, most of what they do is waste time. And it's fine. I waste time. But the thing I show them is, what if you looked at this with intentionality? Is this how you would allocate your time? And you see the biggest chunk of time is the consumption of content in different formats, usually by the internet these days. And the question I asked them was like, is this how you want to spend 4 hours of your waking day? And it's cool if you do. Do you want to produce anything? Do you want to have anything? Do you want to have a legacy? Do you want to work towards a goal? Do you want to meet people? And we kind of probe a little bit. So I don't think the internet in and of itself is something to be feared or loved or worshipped or hated. I think it's on us as adults to make sure that we're working with young people and modeling it ourselves. How many of us, I walk around all the time and I look around everybody is on their phone. And we shouldn't even call it a phone anymore. Everyone is on their handheld internet device. So I think we're not modeling behavior well otherwise for kids too. And one final thought is, activism is not posting. Posting is important. I love when I see people standing up for things. But I'm struck when I, for example, here locally, everyone knows Supreme Court justices' names. But what about the judges that are on the ballot here in California? These are the ones jailing kids. These are the ones enforcing the law. And we skip that section. How many members of the school board in your city actually have kids in school? I can tell you mine. I don't think it's any. Here's the largest factory of equity or inequity. We get to decide, and we're ignorant. But we have this handheld device, but we're watching videos. What if we use that device once a month to log into a school board meeting, which is online? And we asked a question like, hey, when kids are coming out of juvenile justice, how do you create a reentry program? And what are your results? Or hey, how do you handle homeless kids? And is that sufficient? We don't do that. Instead, we watch entertaining videos that distract us. So I think we as adults can not just help young people through kind of laws and policies that protect them, but also just model the behavior. Put your damn phone away. You know, people now text me and say, can I call you? And I'm like, just call me. I think through in real connection, modeling that for young people and each other is really amazing. And it's our natural state. It's why you see, you know, young children play with cardboard boxes, not the internet. I think our natural state is to like be in the real world and be with each other. I look at it as a tool. It's a beautiful tool. It's helped me tremendously. It's opened up the world for me to build community, but it's not the be all end all. And I think we need to consider it thus.
Thank you so much, David. And the conversation is just getting started. We're out of time for this episode, but we'll pick up here in our next episode for Let's Talk with David Ambrose Part 2, where we'll talk about how youth homelessness and poverty have changed over the years, obstacles for young people trying to access life-saving resources, and some of the most effective strategies he's seen when it comes to addressing these issues. Make sure you subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen to podcasts so that you'll get a notification whenever the new episode is released. And remember, transcripts for the Let's Talk podcast are available at 1-800-runaway.org/podcast.